A quick note to the listeners before we get started. Tyler and I recorded this yesterday, April 30th, in the morning, and it was about 12 hours before Columbia, City College, UCLA. And so we want to just give you a note that while you're listening, that a lot of these thoughts were formed before we saw what happened last night. And although we still think a lot of what we talked about was relevant, you know, if there is a mismatch in pitch or if there is a sense of, wait, didn't they watch what happened last night? It's because we recorded it the day before. Thank you for your patience and please enjoy the show. Hello, welcome to Time to Say Goodbye. It is May 1st. Happy May Day, Tyler.
Yeah, thanks, man.
And also happy first day of Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month.
Happy, Jay. I didn't know there was a whole month.
That's yeah, great. Yeah. No, we have a month, too.
Nice. Is there any races that only get like a week? Like, are there any ones in
the
short
change? No. I think everyone is represented at this point. You know, it's like a big month for people like me because sometimes we get invited to give talks.
Yeah.
And then it's like a little bit of extra cash. But this year, I have not been invited to Asian. I don't know what's happening.
Total bullshit.
What happened? You know, invite me.
Maybe there's less racism, Jay. This could be progress.
I don't know. I think, either that or my time is over. You know, I wonder who they're inviting to, you know, be the person from the mainstream media who comes in and talks to X, Y, or Z. It's usually like corporations and stuff like that. But
are they fun? Is it fun to do? Is the food good?
It actually is kind of fun. I find that the ones that are better are the ones that are actually more far afield, let's say, right? Mm-hmm. Like where it's not like something that's within your wheelhouse, like for example, a university or something like that. Those tend to all go the same way.
Yeah.
But sometimes you do stuff like you speak for, what did I do? The strangest one I think I did was the Korean American Spinal Surgeons Association. And that one, you know, like it's nice to sometimes talk to people who are not in the quote unquote knowledge economy or something like that. And see how they respond to
help people.
Yeah. To what you say problems. Or your work or something like that. And, I do like college students, but, there's like a limit to those are much more like I'm giving a talk, right. Mm-hmm. And they have to listen as opposed to some of these other ones where, because they have the feeling perhaps rightfully, hey, we're paying you. So we get to just do whatever we want. You know, you're almost like you're like a magician at a child's like a children's birthday party or something.
Nice.
It can be a little more interesting, but apparently have I been blacklisted? No, I don't think so. I just think that maybe my time is over. All right, I want to start off by playing this clip for you because I think it's something we both saw just to start off the show a little bit light.
I've been thinking that we really all need a tremendous hug in the world right now.
Yeah.
But in our country, we need you to be Mamala of the country.
Okay, that was Drew Barrymore on her talk show. The only reason I know Drew Barrymore has a talk show is because, do you remember she like tried to strike break like at some point?
Oh, yeah.
That's the only reason I know. But that's her with Kamala Harris. And the audio doesn't do it justice, but I don't know. I came across this on my timeline this morning and I watched it at least 10 times because it is the absolute, like, I think that Bhaskar Sankara said that, like, you know, he's the, what's his job now? I think he's the publisher of The Nation, but, you know, former editor of Jacobin was saying that this is like the best that Kamala the most he's ever sympathized with Kamala, and I kind of agree. What'd you think watching
totally this? Oh, it's the first time I've ever found Kamala remotely sympathetic. I mean, my heart just immediately went out to her. Like you, I've seen this like 15 times this morning, and every time I still find it funny. I mean, it's just Mamala, and then the whole audience like cheers. I think that's what does it, you know, that like the audience is like really into it. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is a type of energy that I think you and I have, being minorities, let's say, in that are hang out with a lot of like very earnest, well-intentioned white people. You know, it's a type of energy that I know very, very well.
Totally, I'm deeply familiar with.
It's like this super earnest, like, "Are you okay?" type of thing. And look, I try and be generous in these situations, and I don't say like, you know, this is racist or whatever. Yeah. But I generally make the face that Kamala makes in this clip, which is like a very tight smile and a please stop.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. No, it's like, that's, I mean, it's like definitely not racist. It's just like, so I don't know. It's hard to explain. I feel like unless you're a minority that has been in that kind of space with that kind of person, it's like I don't know. I'm deeply familiar with the tight-lipped smile after the uncomfortable comment by an overly earnest, white lady. But yeah.
Yeah. It happens more than, I don't know. It doesn't happen all the time to me, I think, at this point, just because I'm so unpleasant generally, but you know, it does happen.
You know, no one ever calls you like Papa Jay or anything like that.
No. Also, no one really. I think it's much different between Asian people and Black people.
Yeah.
You know, I think that Black people probably get it 20 times more often than Asian people.
I kind of feel bad for Drew Barrymore. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, I don't, because she like, you know, tried to break a strike, but like if she hadn't done that, I'd feel bad, because it's just like such a, I mean, she's just getting roasted for this thing, and it's just like I feel bad for everyone. It's horrible.
Yeah, well, Kamala, Berkeley's own Kamala, you know, I don't know, it's become, I try and envision what her day-to-day life must be like, right? As an extremely ambitious person who has now been kind of reduced to this national running joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that, who is, I guess, going to just be the vice president again if Biden wins, right? And is going to, I mean, I don't know. It's, what does she do all day, right? Like, what does she think about? I think that people compare it to the show Veep, which is, you know, one of my favorite TV shows. I think it's probably kind of similar to that, right? Like, it's like, how do I sort of make my presence felt? And then just this comedy of errors over and over again. It's like, oh yeah, I'll go on Strike Breaker Drew Barrymore's show that nobody really knows exists. And then I'll have her like pander to me in this totally cringy way. And then I'll make this weird face that actually makes me likable for, you know, the first time in however long.
Right? I will love to see if her like approval rating goes up after this. You know, like maybe she'll get a bump. I mean, the thing that kills me about Kamala is like when you talk to other Black folks about it, you know, if you're like, maybe they should replace her because no one likes her, they're like, that is ridiculous. That's racist. You can't replace Kamala. And then you're like, but do you like Kamala? Like, that's not the point. It's like, no one likes Kamala. Like, I mean, I feel like it kind of is the point, you know, if nobody likes her, including you, like, I feel like we don't just have to keep her, but you know.
Well, they can't replace anything at this point,
think. No, of course.
Like, the idea that they would change a thing now, it's like kind of like you're, it's like they've basically committed to this very narrow, narrow path, and they're hurtling towards it. And if anything goes wrong, the whole thing explodes. They just have to hope that everything kind of holds together. And I don't know. I still think it's going to hold together, but whatever. What do I know? You know, I'm wrong generally about every big major world event and trying to predict over the last 5 years. So I'm not going to say anything, but, you know, I don't think that they should change the vice president. Like, who would they even nominate? Like,
there's Gretchen, no one. I don't Whitmer. Like anyone. Yeah.
Like, none of the people who would, I don't even think any of the people who are the most obvious candidates would even do the job, right? Like, is Gavin Newsom really going to stop being governor of California and like a potential future president to go run with Joe Biden? He's not going to do that. Anyway, this week we have a mailbag episode for you, and we are going to go into some of your questions, and then Tyler and I are going to preview something that I think we're going to do occasionally on the show, which is a more rapid fire type of thing. This is for weeks where we don't have a guest, just so that we can keep things moving and snappy, right? I do like the long form discursive conversations that we have, but occasionally we want to change it up just for you. And also because, you know, at some point I get sick of us going on and on and on, not you, but me, you know, going on and on and on about things. So here's our first question. I enjoy the surfing, fishing talk and wonder if there could be a future episode with a good guest that delves further into the growth of extreme outdoors activities / hobbies. I'm sorry to whoever submitted this question, but we're not going to do a future episode, but we're going to talk about it here. Maybe I'm overstating this because I live in the Pacific Northwest, but it feels like something that has been in the zeitgeist during the era of smartphones and big tech domination, and also something that is only getting bigger. I trail run, and it's been wild to see the community around ultra distance running keep growing and growing, and to see a widening variety of bodies, ideologies, etc. in that world as well. Tyler, as a person who does his own weird, I'm going to just call it weird, it's fucking weird.
It's, you know, super weird, yeah.
You put on a wetsuit and go dive in the waters of Maine to, like, I don't know, catch fish that you could just catch on a dock.
Yeah.
At 3 a.m. when you could. Like, I caught striped bass in Maine off, I don't know if I caught many, but I caught at least one that I can remember off my dock in Georgetown, Maine, at the house I lived on in high school. At like 5 in the afternoon. No, it didn't require me to put on a wetsuit.
Totally.
And dive in. So yeah, Tyler, what's your take on this? The sort of the explosion of weird extreme sports.
No, man, I think it's totally right. And I think it's kind of part of, you know, what they're saying about just the omnipresence of technology and our phones and everything else. I mean, fishing season starting right around now, but the wetsuiting really kicks off in a couple of weeks. But you know, it's like, I'm in the kind of like pre-traumatic, like stress phase where I'm like, I'm going to be really cold and I'm not going to get any sleep for 6 months, etc. But I'm sure, you know, once it starts, I always look forward to it. But yeah, I think it's, you know, the appeal is just a lot of these. I mean, I'm sure surfing is the same way. I mean, just structurally based on the kind of activity it is, it's not one that is super susceptible to a bunch of gadgetry and technological mediation and phones and everything else. You know, I mean, I've said this before, but one of the reasons why I find the, you know, the fishing at night thing appealing, I mean, the fish are larger and it's fun, and that's part of it, but it's also, you know, there's just like no way to document it really. It's very hard to get photographs. You know, I just keep my phone in a bag under my wetsuit. You know, you can't, it's, you're just very, by kind of necessity, you know, unplugged from all the whiz bangs. And I think that's definitely part of the appeal. I think, as weird as the particular hobby is, it's one that's like definitely growing. And I think that's, you know, that's definitely part of it. But a lot of it, you know, more extreme activities, whether, like they point out, ultra running is huge in Maine, and I see more of it every year. I think all of these things are kind of exploding as a kind of rejection of, you know, at least a temporary rejection for a couple hours, you know, every day or a week or whatever.
You see it as a reaction to online life, right?
Like, yeah,
you
see it, oh yeah, like,
we spend so much time staring at screens, and so I have to, in the short period of time where I'm not staring at a screen, I have to do the most intense thing ever, right? I can't just read a book or go for a walk. I have to do this weird thing that is invigorating and interesting as well. All right, yeah, I don't know. I go ahead, because like for wetsuiting, which is the thing that you do, and for the, why don't you explain it to the listeners who don't know, who haven't heard you explain it before?
Yeah, so it's a kind of fishing for striped bass that got started in Montauk, New York. And you wear a wetsuit so you can, striped bass are a species that migrates, but they're, you know, ocean-based. So you can wear a wetsuit that will let you deep wade or swim out to rocks offshore that you can fish from to access different areas in deeper water and whatnot. And it usually takes place at night, mainly because the striped bass, larger striped bass, are pretty nocturnal and they come into shore at night to feed. And so if you're hunting bigger fish, which, you know, most people who do this kind of thing are and putting on the wetsuit and doing the whole nine yards are looking for bigger fish. That's you know, that's how it works. But you know, a lot of the best fishing too is during you know, really inclement weather, so storms, you know, the front edge of hurricanes, etc. So there's definitely this kind of extreme element element to it. But I do think that the extremism is part of the appeal. But for me, beyond just like the phone thing, I also think, I mean, I've said this before, but I think I really kind of bristle at the sort of documentary impulse that we're all that is, you know, so part of our life, where you have to take pictures of everything and document what you're doing, etc. And I think the fishing thing is interesting because you know, there's no real glory to it. I mean, it's very hard to people don't really understand it. You know, I was interviewing a guy recently about this. I'm working on a thing, and he was like, you know, he's done this for a long time. He guides down in Montauk, and he's like, you know, you can't really explain it to anybody. You're out on a rock at 3 a.m. and, you know, getting hit in the chest with 4-foot waves. And he's like, you know, you can describe to people what's happening, but they can't really understand what that's like. It's just like a totally foreign concept that you really have to experience to get. And I think there's something to that that's appealing, that it's like a kind of activity that is really singular, and it doesn't lend itself to this sort of social media impulse to
document. Is that true though? Because I've seen wetsuiting. I, you know, since getting to know you, I started looking for wetsuiting content on Instagram and TikTok. There's not much of it, but it does seem like some dudes bring out like a flashlight and a GoPro, and they kind of, you know, like they make little, I find actually the vlogs or whatever they make to be kind of entertaining, because I will say, as somebody who also spends an inordinate amount of time a week in a wetsuit, that I just cannot see the appeal of this. It seems scary and dangerous, right? But then I watch some of these vlogs and I'm like, okay, I kind of get it now. I see the excitement. Yeah. You're on this weird little rock, right? And you're kind of squatting there.
Yeah,
and it look tough, right? And nobody really understands what the fuck you're doing.
Totally.
And the bigger thing they don't understand is that at some point in the history of mankind, you know, there was an invention that allows you to float above the water in like in a much more safe and dry type of way. It's like, why don't you just take a little rowboat out there and drop a line in the water? But I guess that's not the point of it, right?
No, there's a saying actually, people who wetsuit boat fish don't count, because it's just like easier, you know. It just like, it doesn't. I think it's like, you know, it's like anything. It's like a video game on, I don't play video games, but like a video game on hard mode or something, right? It doesn't count if it's easy. But yeah, I mean, you can find content on Instagram. People should definitely look. It's like really, the videos are often entertaining. The people who are really serious think those people are kind of dorks for the most part. I mean, there are a few exceptions,
right? But that's true in surfing too. Yeah.
And like,
there's,
for example,
nothing worse than when you at a surf break, then, or more eye rolling, is when you see somebody who's bad at surfing with like a GoPro.
It's
even worse because like there's this form of GoPro. It used to be like the GoPro sat at the beginning at the front of your board and showed you catching it. But that's like, it was never a good video because the angle sucks, right? You can't see the wave. So what you see is, you see somebody like kind of spring to their feet and their mouth opens and like, you know, and like that's basically it. But now, for some bizarre reason that I don't understand, there's a new type of camera that is encased in like soft plastic rubber, and the people put it in their fucking mouth. That's how they hold it. So they look like a dog, you know? And now, I have seen footage from these cameras like at Cloud Break or some of these like incredible waves where it looks awesome, right? You can see you basically have to get barreled, which is impossible, right? But if you're getting barreled and you have one of those, it looks really cool, right?
Sure.
But then you go out to where I surf, where nobody has ever been barreled. Maybe 3 people get barreled a year. And you see these people with these fucking dog mouth cameras, and it's like the worst feel. Like it's impossible to feel anything but contempt towards them, even if you're trying to be nice about it. You're just like, first of all, you look ridiculous, and secondly, you're like what footage are you trying to capture other than you being bad at surfing?
Totally.
But yeah, anyway, so that seems to also be true in the wetsuit.
Yeah, like, I mean, one of the guys who's the best. One of the best dudes at this, and has been for a long time.
But how are you good? How what constitutes good?
Catching large fish, doing it consistently throughout the year. I mean, there's just a, I mean, one of the pieces that's interesting about it is also it's like very intellectual. You have to know like when the bait fish are arriving, what bait fish are in, what, you know, how the fish feed in relation to different moon and wind conditions, et cetera. So there's a lot of moving parts. I mean, how I describe it is it's as technical as fly fishing. And for like, you know, the guys who are really into fly fishing for like brook trout in the middle of nowhere, it's like technical like that. But then it combines this kind of extreme sport element. So I think it's interesting in that way. But yeah, one of the guys who's I mean, one of the best and has been for a long time, just like takes photos of almost nothing. Like you'll find no photos of him on the internet. But he's really, really good. And he broke, you know, 50 pounds is kind of the like gold standard. Like that's a once in a lifetime fish and most people will never get anything north 50 or even close. But he has a couple, but you know, he had one this past summer and didn't even take a photo of it, you know.
A 50 pound striped bass?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How do you know he did it if he didn't take a photo?
Exactly. That's why it's great. You know, I mean, he's won a lot of tournaments where, you know, right. There are like weigh-ins and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think that's part of what I find appealing about it is that like a lot of people do it really seriously, do not do it for like clout or glory or public recognition or in any way, you know, and they just have, they kind of have this like mystique because everyone knows they're really good. Cause you know, every once in a while they'll, you know, be a tournament or something and it's like, oh, that guy won again, you know? But I think that's like part of the appeal is, I think there aren't a lot of activities like that where you can be really, really excellent. And the people that are really, really excellent are also secretive and not especially interested in like recognition of any kind, you know?
Right. It seems to have the same divide in surfing between the sole surfer and then the guy who's just trying to get on tour or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like the fame surfer. And both categories are silly, but I don't know. The Barbarian Days, for example, which is by far the best book ever written about surfing by William Finnegan, has a whole thing about the place where I go surfing, which is Ocean Beach, San Francisco. And it's about the divide between this guy named Pee-wee, who is, you know, the surfer that Finnegan really respects, who would just go out and crush. And then Doc Reniker, who, you know, I think that Finnegan has a more complicated relationship with, who's like the big man who's always giving interviews and sort of being the macho guy. Anyway, whatever. All right. Next question. Question two. We got a few questions about this, so I want to lump them all together. But broadly, they ask about what our take is in the fact that some of these schools are reinstating the SAT. Do we think that this is a good idea?
I mean, yes, I guess is my answer. Broadly speaking, I mean, I tend to think there's like no way to reform higher ed, honestly. Like, I think it's just like very profoundly broken. And so, I mean, I think this is like, you know, we're tinkering with a thing that is like really just teetering on its last leg. But yeah, I think bringing back the SAT, I mean, I do think there's like a real evidence-based claim to be made that even though no system is perfect for admissions, that SATs remain the least kind of purchasable and gameable of all the like different admissions criteria, right? I mean, part of what's behind this is that, you know, as we've seen with stuff like Varsity Blues, right? It's really easy for wealthy people to throw tons and tons of money into holistic admissions criteria, like extracurriculars or whatever. And so, you know, originally these schools went to more holistic criteria, thinking that it would, you know, less of a focus on scores would be good for minorities in certain ways. And that really hasn't proven to be true because, you know, again, the sort of softer criteria are easier to game. So I do think there's, you know, it's probably good to reintroduce the SAT. I was definitely someone who benefited from the SAT. I was just kind of planning to go to a state school, and then to my surprise did really well on the PSAT. And my counselor was like, you know, when you take the SAT, you know, you should, if your scores are similar, you should think about a different caliber of school than you were looking at. So I was definitely one of those people who benefited from, you know, the SAT thing. But at the same time, like I, you know, was a college tutor for a really long time, half a decade in New York. I did a lot of college counseling, but I also did SAT and ACT. And I think, you know, some of the studies that suggest that you can't, that tutoring doesn't improve scores that much. Like there are a number of studies that say this, but those studies, to my view at least, don't often really replicate what like actual elite tutoring looks like. Like, yes, your average person is, you know, just taking a college prep course or an SAT prep course that is not going to balloon their score a ton. But I would have people that would call me for their middle schooler and would be like, I, you know, want to get him started on an SAT. And they would do this for years. And I didn't take anyone in middle school because I thought that was fucked up. But I worked with 9th graders and 10th graders, absolutely, you know. And so like when you're talking about families that are paying thousands and thousands of dollars a year for many years of SAT, ACT tutoring, I refuse to believe that isn't making a difference in the score. I mean, it's just like it obviously is.
Right. But that's pretty uncommon to have that much tutoring, right? And that is sort of the question of, I mean, it's a complicated question because yes, it's a small number of people, but for these elite schools where this type of stuff actually matters, they also have a small pool of people who actually get in. And some of those, I imagine, or at least the higher concentration of the people who would use services like you, are probably looking at those schools, right? People aren't spending thousands of dollars in 3 years of their kids' lives to go to a school that has 75%
honestly, acceptance or even rate. Like 40 or 50% acceptance rate. Yeah, they're like it's the tippy top.
I tend to agree. I think that I looked at those studies too, and I wrote that I didn't think that this sort of broad idea that SAT tutoring was going to help that much. I was talking more in the main, but it seemed like what was true was that in Asian enclaves where they start very early, including in middle school, that they are quite effective at test prep because it's so, it is just so, it just happens so much. They just do so much of it. But that the idea that you can buy the Princeton Review and improve your score by 200 points is not true. I think my views on this have been made pretty clear. I don't think that college admissions is a good idea generally. I think that they should completely overhaul the system of higher education in America to make it much more accessible. Elite colleges should all be taxed out of existence, et cetera, whatever, right? Like, I don't need to re-go over all of that. Within the system that we have, the idea that you take out the SAT so that you can kind of do the work of elite college admissions and creating the perfect class that they want, which is just a little bit of diversity, all rich kids, maybe 4 kids who aren't rich that they're going to put on a brochure or haul out in front of like trials, you know, to give amicus briefs or whatever, or to like be speakers. And like, I just find that all to be terrible. And I would say that I think that they should just do away with GPA and they should not look at extracurriculars and they should just look at one test score that you get to take like 3 times. And they should just make admissions based on that because I don't know, man, like it's hard to have 4 years of stability. It's hard to have 4 years, especially if you're not rich. It's very hard to have 4 years of really good grades. I would say that's much harder and much more privileged than somebody who can just kind of do it well on a test. It's very hard to do extracurriculars as well. You know, I've started to notice that there are all these little, as my daughter gets older and is getting more advanced in the soccer, youth soccer world, there are all these things that exist where your kid can get selected to these little teams that are not part of their main club. And I think a lot of them exist so that people can say, oh, I made this and this and this as an athlete, right? But I'm not quite good enough to be recruited to your school, but I have all these decorations and I was pretty good, right? Or it's not just I was captain of my high school team. It's like, oh, I did like, you know, this training program and this training program. And in a way, it's a resume builder. And I always think, well, what's it a resume builder for? Like either your kid can play or they can't, right? But I think for many parents, it's like, oh, they want their kid to play and it's fun or whatever. But I think the reason why there's so much of it is because there's probably this additional benefit that it helps pad student resumes.
Yes.
And that's for like the sport part of it is much smaller than everything else, like academic. There's all these academic little awards and societies that you can join. There are all these little like, it's not just National Honor Society. Now there's like 30 versions of that and all that costs money. And so extracurriculars, I think, is the worst of it. I only did one extracurricular in high school, debate. you know, I did pretty well in it for, you know, being in a public high school in North Carolina. But I was very, very focused on it. It was very important to me. And I don't think I would have cared about it if I was doing 30 other extracurriculars. Yeah, like, I just wouldn't have had the time. And so the way they do it now is absolutely stupid. They should just get rid of it. And just, it doesn't have to be the SAT. Just make one standardized test for everybody. If you get over a certain percentage, then you get to go to a state school and they randomly distribute the kids throughout all the different state schools. And if you have to travel, they give you a little bit of extra money if you're going from, say, San Diego to Berkeley or something like that, right? Like, to help pay for the cost of traveling back and forth. Like, that seems like the fairest way to do it. And they try and keep you as much as possible within 100 miles of your house, right? That's the best way.
I totally agree with the, like, geographical point. I mean, geographical distribution is a huge thing in college admissions that colleges really care about, because they like to be able to say, we have kids from all 50 states, which has, like, a weird historical precedence. I mean, this even dates back to, I think, the 20s and 30s, where this was, like, an important metric, because it was like, well, kids are traveling from California to go to Harvard, and that was, like, part of the prestige. But we don't live in that world anymore, and I also don't care about that particular kind of prestige economy. I do think it is bad how many kids, you know, are going to state schools out of state. I just think it's ridiculous. I really think.
Yes, I agree.
I don't think
that
should be a right. Yeah. Like,
I'm like a nativist when it comes to
stuff. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at a school like UVA, like Virginia, many parts of Virginia are a really poor state. And UVA, I mean, it's an excellent school, or Michigan or whatever. But, like, I just think, I'm a total nativist about this too. Like, I don't see why you need to be going to state schools. I mean, there is, like, some, I guess you might call it, like, an equity piece. Like, a lot of, there are schools that are poor, and, like, if your state schools are really poor and don't have resources or whatever, I understand. Or maybe there's a program somewhere else that is really good, but I just, in general, I think it's ridiculous. Like, people should go to schools in their state.
Yeah, I mean, there are exceptions, but, like, it shouldn't be. When I was growing up in 1990, when I graduated from high school in 1998, I think that the number of out-of-state students at UNC Chapel Hill was a fraction of what it is now. You know, it's much more. And the reason for that is obvious, because they can call from a larger group of kids. They can up their average SAT scores and their exclusivity, and they can also charge more for tuition, right? It's like a win-win-win, except for the kids from in-state who are kind of screwed out of a state education because the people who run the universities are so addicted to prestige and money. Anyway, enough about that. Next question. Tyler, you're going to have to sit this one out. Actually, you know what? You can join in and solidarity. Yeah, yeah.
I'll be an ally, Jay. I'm sitting here in allyship.
Yeah. All right. This person wants a stat NCAA March Madness bracket of, say, the best Asian diaspora or Asian national athletic performances and see who takes the crown. That's a good question. Look, there have been many great Asian American athletes. I think that the one that I think that I always end up on that is not Shohei Ohtani, because I just frankly I can't really care about baseball that much, right? And I don't think that many people do at this point, outside of people who are just fans of a specific team. Linsanity, I loved it. Two of the best weeks of my life, but it kind of fizzled out, and everyone, you know, that's not something that is, no shade to Jeremy at all, but, you know, it's not something that was long lasting. I would say that the best Asian diaspora or Asian national athlete of our lives was Manny Pacquiao, who I think at this point has become wildly underrated and underappreciated in a way, for reasons that I kind of understand, because he wasn't, you know, the most charismatic speaker. But in terms of popularity at the time, in terms of accomplishments, eight belts, eight different weight divisions, modern day Henry Armstrong, one of the great fighters of all time. If you make any type of list, if you leave him off of it, you're crazy. Huge box office draw. Fought every great Mexican fighter, which, you know, I'm not saying if you don't understand boxing, then you don't understand why that's not like a pejorative or racial statement, but, you know, defeating every great Mexican champion at that time, Juan Manuel Marquez, who, you know, ultimately got the better of Manny, Eric Morales, Barrera, right? I'm not even going to include somebody like Margarito because I don't think he deserves it, you know? Beating Oscar De La Hoya in a fight where he, I think, was a 7-1 underdog. I mean, these are accomplishments that I don't think any other Asian athlete has come close to. And so I would say that Manny Pacquiao is the great Asian athlete of our lifetime. Part of that is because I'm a boxing fan.
I did not
fan.
Know that, actually.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, I went to all these fights. Wow. Because it was when I was at Grantland. And, you know, I will just say that it was, I wrote about my time at Grantland this week. So maybe this is like Grantland reflection time for me in life. But I wanted to report on things because when I was at Grantland, I had this realization where I was like, you know, if I'm going to be a journalist, and I, you know, up until I was at Grantland, that was not really a real goal of mine. I wanted to be a novelist, but if I want to be a journalist, I have one skill, which is that I can write quite fast. And I think that I'm like pretty good at writing, but I'm not a very good reporter because I've never done it before. And so the first piece I ever reported was in the New York Times Magazine. I wrote about like a online poker whiz. And I remember feeling this amazing sort of fraudulence about it because it, like, it's crazy to have your first experience of reporting be in a
magazine. Yeah.
I was just like, what the fuck? What has happened in my life? And so I spent, when I was at Grantland, you know, and I think that this is much credit to the people who ran Grantland, was that they kind of let me stop editing, in part, I think, because I was like probably not the greatest presence around the office, but I can admit that now. But they let me report on a whole bunch of stuff, and boxing is the best sport to report on because the athletes, like, they'll just let you do anything. Like, they'll let you hang out with them. They'll let you go to training. They'll give long talks with you if they're not famous. And that's partial. And in a way that NBA, which obviously in terms of the four major sports, my favorite sport, like the NBA players will give you nothing, right? The teams will give you nothing. And so almost out of necessity, because I wanted to learn how to report, I just really started to write a lot about boxing, which I had always enjoyed, but then I got really into it, going to the fights and everything like that. And I still think right now that has shifted, and the real place of opportunity is mixed martial arts, UFC, MMA. Those athletes will give you a lot of time. They'll give you some access, and they always have much more interesting lives than the NBA players who just basically have played AAU. Like, that's basically, you know, like, a lot, some of them have more interesting lives than that, but, you know, a lot of them, you just get guys who just have, all they've done is play basketball. Fighters are fucked up, like, fucked up people. Like, they're not, like, it's so rare when they're rich, right? They always come from horrific backgrounds. They're always dealing with a whole bunch of stuff. And in a way, like, they're the most sympathetic athletes to me because they're exploited a lot, especially in UFC right now, which has just a horrific labor participation. And they, more than anyone else, just put it all on the line for the audience in this way where you have to develop such a respect for the sport when you watch people do this stuff. And they train, they learn all sorts of stuff. It is an intellectual exercise. They have to be really smart to be great at it. And I think it's undercovered right now. So if there are any up and coming sports writers in the audience, I would suggest that you start covering UFC because it is growing. The labor conditions are definitely worth writing about, and the athletes are, you're going to find like a lot of interesting people. Every other major American sport has basically been shut off from any type of interesting writing. So anyway.
No. You maybe want to watch boxing. So, yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on the most interesting Asian athletes as a black ally?
No. You covered, I mean, I always think about Yao Ming because I was in high school during like peak Yao Ming, and that was like a huge thing. But you know, no, I think you I'm going to blank on his name, but the kicker for Atlanta, I really love. I think he's awesome.
Oh, yeah, Young Wei Koo.
He's awesome. Yeah. And I'm like, more broadly, I like that we have kickers with personality now. Like, he has a personality, you know, and then the kid who kicks for the Bengals has a personality. So, yeah, I'm into the kind of kicker renaissance we've had.
I know. I think it's mostly because of Pat McAfee. Like, he gave punters and kickers like the license to be
totally
and to try and promote themselves.
Absolutely.
Whereas before they're always almost embarrassed, right? Like, there was like, I'm the kicker type of thing, and now they can.
Except for Dave Akers, I was an Eagles fan, and so Dave Akers used to level people. He was one of the only cool kickers when I was younger, you know, from a generation or so ago. But
okay, I have a take then as an Eagles take, right? Okay, and this is not something I actually think, but it's something I had a thought about that I thought was funny. I really want to say that I don't actually believe this, but I just thought it was a funny. It would have been like a funny tweet back when like you could tweet stuff like this without people flooding your mentions, calling you like a reverse racist or something. In the state of Pennsylvania, is a David Akers jersey like basically a white nationalist flag?
Oh my God, that's actually right. I think that's kind of actually true. I didn't think about it, but I think that's like kind of right. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, because I was like, I used to go to those bars to watch football in New York City all the time, you know, and when I lived there. And every Sunday, I would just park at some bar. And whenever there's a Phillies fan out, the most obnoxious Philly fans would always be wearing David Akers jersey.
That's good. Yeah. Maybe it is. Oh, who knows? Man,
yeah. But. I didn't actually think that they were white nationalists, but it would have been a fun thing to think. They were fucking annoying. I will say that, like, the most annoying Philly fans.
I do think Pennsylvania, though, like the Pittsburgh is like the racist team of the like the they have the racist fans compared to Philly, but the Philly fans are like worse.
Oh, really? So how do they deal with Mike Tomlin?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a really good question. He's one. I was going to say he's one of the good ones. I mean, also, how can you not like Mike Tomlin? I mean, Mike Tomlin's great, you know? Like, I don't think they think he counts.
Yeah, you have to be so racist.
Yeah, you have to be, like, really super racist, you know?
I know. That is one of the nuances that I think that was lost in the sort of woke era, let's call it, right? Which was that it's actually funny to make jokes about people who are really racist, you know, instead of calling and making gradations of racism. So anti-Mike Tomlin people are like probably the most. Like, if you don't like Mike Tomlin because he's black, like, you're a level of racist
really beyond the pale.
Yeah. If you're a normal racist, you just say he's 100%. One of the good ones, right? Yeah. And then if you're... All right. So those are our questions. What was your response to, like, how are you feeling about what's happening at Columbia right now?
I continue to be furious. I mean, I think the administration is just entirely bungling this response. I think it is making, you know, I've been talking to a lot of people about this, and pro-Israel people, pro-Palestine people, faculty, staff, everyone across the board agrees that it is making everyone less safe, you know. But I think the students are doubling down because they're kids and that's what they do. And, you know, I, you know, people are like, well, they don't have the right to take, like, are you suggesting they get no punishment? And the answer is obviously no. Like, when you overtake a building, like, of course you expect there to be punishment. To me, that's entirely beside the point. And the question is, I mean, the way that these universities sell and trade on their radical history and celebrate 1968, 1969, I mean, there are a bunch of universities that do this. And then they want to turn around and demonize these students. I mean, I think it's patently ridiculous. And so, yeah, I'm just, I mean, the thing that I think is good about it, and I say this in the hopes that we don't have a Kent State situation, because, I mean, there's been violence that I think is escalating in the police response that is really concerning. But assuming we don't have a Kent State situation, I think the thing that is good about this is that it's finally exposed these elite institutions for what they are, right? Which is that predatory, hostile, absolutely not on the side of students. The idea that...
Or faculty, but
exactly. And I think that's good. Like, I think there should be an antagonistic relationship between faculty, students, and then the administration. That's how it used to be. I think that that antagonistic relationship is fine and good. And I think this lets us see universities for, I think, what people like you and I have been saying for a while that they are, which is just these corporate, you know, basically hedge funds with hospitals attached. And so I think, provided that no one is seriously injured, And, you know, I think on balance, I think this is like a healthy development, because I think after this, it will be absolutely impossible to believe any of the bullshit about anti-racism and DEI and this and that. Like everyone, I think it's very clear what these institutions are now, you know. And so I think that's good. You know, I think it's always good to see power clearly. And I think there's been a lot about the branding of higher ed that has prevented us from seeing that clearly for a while. So I welcome it to that extent.
Yeah, I think that it's good when idiots who run trading firms or whatever say they're not going to hire any Columbia graduates. I think it's good. I think if the general value of elite education goes down as a result, I'm skeptical that it will. But if it does, that's a positive, right? Now, is violence a justifiable way to achieve those ends? Totally. No. And I don't think that the ends actually even warrant, important, right? Especially given the seriousness of what is being protested. And so that's just like cloud talk, basically. Like, what if this happened and wouldn't that be funny type of thing? But like overall, I will echo your concern about some of the police response that I have seen. The stuff at Emory was I don't think it was shocking. I mean, I've covered I've seen a lot worse. However, I will say that, you know, I think that it's just mind-boggling that the universities are doubling down on this type of stuff after seeing this, right? I don't think that there's any world in which the public sentiment is not going to swing towards student protesters unless they start torching things, right? Omar Wazow is quite good on this, and I just generally think that he's right about a lot of this stuff, where it's just like, if they're peacefully protesting and they get beat up by the cops, it's gonna swing public opinion in their way. We're dealing with a very divided country on this issue that is swinging more towards sentiments, you know, more towards ceasefire at the very least, right? And more sympathy towards people in Gaza. And that amongst young people, the polling, and I don't know what to make of this polling, but it's the polling. I mean, 85% of people under the age of 35 disapprove of how Joe Biden is handling this conflict. 85% is all. I mean, that's like a significant number. Young people, I think, on the whole, are going to see this and that they're going to feel like, you know, there's repression going on, there's censorship going on, that there is and how are they going to respond? And what are they going to think about these elite institutions going forward? I think that we in the media also are facing that same existential question, which is just like, does anybody trust us anymore? Does anyone put stock in the fact that we're, you know, a reporter from the New Yorker or the Atlantic for young people? I don't think so.
I think they think like, we're hostile media, you know.
And it doesn't even really matter if you say, actually, these are my views on this and this is my hit. Like, it's the affiliation with the place is enough. And it's hard to say that they're wrong in a lot of ways, right? And so my question to you about this was just, do you think that there's two existential crises going on. First, I think, is the one that we talked with Danny Bester about, which is that it really does seem like liberalism right now is under intense strain. Things like DEI, whatever, I just think it's over. Like, I think it's over. Like, I think that this, since October 7th, what has happened on campus is in DEI might exist within corporations or whatever, but it's going to be slowly or maybe even quickly phased out. I don't think that it's going to have the bureaucratic power that it had before. But certainly in terms of a way of persuasion and a way of discourse, like it's wiped out. It doesn't exist anymore. And it is a big victory for the right in many ways, right? Because I think you and I are sort of in the same page on this, which is that like DEI is kind of cringe, but like there are some ways in which it is useful and some of its core critiques are not wrong, right? But, and it's not necessarily bad that something like that has a lot of bureaucratic power, but it's over. Like part's over. The second existential crisis is the one that's been going on now since, I guess, like Trump or before that, which is just like, what do we do with these institutions now? What power do they have? They're just under constant, constant assault. And so, yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really do think we are at the, like I said, I think this is a moment where it's become clear to everyone what these institutions are. I've been talking to, like I said, a lot of folks in last week, including a lot of faculty of color who at these places that where there have been arrests, who were the kind of people that previously would have, who were leftists, who would have been like, look, like DEI is kind of silly in various ways, but like, they were kind of like anti-DEI in that they like not incorrectly recognized that the critiques of DEI were coming from the right, that they were often racist. And so they didn't want to align with that anyway. But after all of this, like a lot of faculty I've talked to are like, I'm fucking, this is the last DEI committee I'll serve on. Like, I'm not doing it. Like, I refuse. I mean, I've heard talks.
And is that because the DEI office did not step exactly. up in the way
yes,
that they thought
100%. They did? I mean, yeah. Literally Princeton, I saw on Twitter earlier, was like processing kids for arrest at the DEI office.
Yeah,
it's so good. So like, yeah, I think like a lot of, I think there have been, like, I think most faculty of color in my experience are like, I'm way more critical of DEI than most. And I think like, I'm on the fringe. There's like a group that is like super, super pro.
Well, a black faculty, yeah. I would say.
And then there's like super like deep pro DEI, like, you know, 25% or whatever. And then there's this like middle 50% that is sort of like, I mean, it's like silly and performative in a bunch of ways and not especially helpful, but like nonetheless, like the people who are opposed to it are assholes. So I don't want to side with them. And that 50% now is like, fuck this, you know, because I mean, at NYU, they've done all these, you know, they've done all this hiring around issues related to equity and activism, protests, et cetera, targeted hiring. And now some of those faculty are among the faculty arrested. Like, it's just, it's total horseshit. So I do think you're right that DEI is basically done, which I think will be bad in a number of ways. Because I think there are few administrative human resources related functions for DEI that are important. And I think those will honestly just be quietly subsumed back into HR and they'll be called different things and it'll probably be fine. But, you know, I do think, you know, the sheen of progressivism at these institutions is done. And I think some of them that have handled this well may become schools that we think of as like, those are the schools that like are more serious about their values or whatever. But the Princetons and the NYUs and the, you know, the Yales and the Columbias, I don't think there's going to be any shortage of students. I don't think there's going to be a meaningful threat to their operating financially or otherwise. I think there's other donors waiting in the wings will give them plenty of money. There are tons of unscrupulous students that just want to go to Wall Street that will be super happy to, you know, go to Columbia, even if, you know, I've talked to some folks at some of these universities or who are admitted that are incoming that are like, I regret going. Like, I wish I was going to a different university. Yeah. But I think those are, that's like a small percent, you know? And so I don't think this is going to have a material impact, but I do think that on the like actual operating and finances of these institutions, they are, you know, as they say, too big to fail. But I do think the culture is going to change very quickly in a way that will be like, everyone is just going to accept that these are engines of elite reproduction that a few impoverished students get to go to and like get a leg up into the next sphere. And that's fine and good. But we don't have to pretend that these are, you know, the levers that bend the arc of the universe towards justice. And I think that's good. You know, I think that's healthy. Like, I don't need Harvard to be a bastion of social progress. Like, that's not what it's for. Like, I think there are a lot of people that feel betrayed and I'm like, it's fine. Like, let it, that's the whole institution exists to send people to Google and Wall Street and like, just let it do that. Like, that's fine. Like, I think it's evil and bad, but like, I just would rather we, you know, stop lying about what, you know, what these things are for.
And people are still going to send their kids to these universities if they get in.
Of course.
Right. And the kids will still go even if they find the idea repulsive or they disagree. But I think that we're now entering a period of what is going to be endless student protest for a while until it's not. And the parallels, obviously, to the late 60s, early 70s are quite apparent to anybody who's paying attention. And the real question is whether or not things escalate to a point where, you know, something violent does happen. And then we have a somewhat profoundly changed country after that. Right now, I think it's all building towards that, and I would be kind of shocked, even though I am sort of saddened by it. Not even sort of, I am just saddened by it. But I think we're going to that point right now.
That's the track the student, we're on, for sure.
Right. Universities seem committed to doing the stupidest responses possible. Not all the universities, but man, I would love to spend a day in the head of Baroness Shafiq at Columbia.
Do you know Manoush is kitten, I think is the translation, which kills me.
I think we discussed this in the Claudine Gay episode ad nauseum. We don't have to, but one does not become a university president based on the strength of scholarship. You become a based on connections and just ravenous personal ambition. You know, like that's how you become a university president. All right, next topic. Has woke, this is, I'm reading off our sheet. This is what Tyler put in. Has wokeness actually killed television and comedy, like Jerry Seinfeld says? What did Jerry Seinfeld
basically
say?
Basically that. He's like, yeah, you know, we don't have any good sitcoms anymore because of the wokes, right? They've neutered comedy. You can't say anything funny anymore, etc. I mean, you see this version of a version of this critique leveled any number of times, but...
I mean, Jerry Seinfeld's been saying it for 20 years.
I have no sense as to like what you think about. Like, what do you think about that? Like, I think it is. It's gotten a lot of play on the internet in the last couple of days. Mainly, people making fun of Jerry Seinfeld for being irrelevant since Seinfeld, and you know, saying Larry David did all the work, which is probably right. But yeah, like, what do you think? Is he right?
Well, young people don't watch network television or television. Period. Their interfacing with comedy is all through short form video, social media content like Instagram Reels or YouTube, mostly YouTube Shorts, I think, and TikTok, right? And that within that world, it is much less woke than one would find on a network show. Mm-hmm. That's true, right? So, for example, Cameron and Mace do a sports talk show, right? And it is, they had OJ Simpson as their NFL correspondent.
I did not know that.
So every week on Monday, OJ Simpson would come on and say wild shit that I would sometimes be like, whoa, I'm a huge Cameron fan. I was like, I don't even know if I'm comfortable.
That's awesome.
They pushed the envelope in ways that's just wild because they are famous rappers, and famous rappers are the most uncancelable people on the planet. You like, what are you? You're going to cancel Cameron? You know, like they could do whatever they want, right? And as a result, the show, while sometimes like deeply uncomfortable, is also sometimes the funniest thing I've ever seen. You know, it's just so funny because Cameron, I think, is a comedic genius, and Mace is really, really good too. Obviously, Shane Gillis has gotten
he's from Mechanicsburg, where I grew up.
Social media.
He's like
star.
The most dude. He's oh, really? The most he Mechanicsburg guy to ever walk the earth. Like, if you like, that's like exactly what every person where I grew up is like. Like, it's not even a bit. He's just like doing the thing. Yeah.
Like an Eagles jersey and a Notre Dame polo and like kind of heavy.
Yeah.
White
yeah.
Guy.
Yeah. That's like, that's the whole thing. And the like the humor of the whole thing is just like, it's very specifically central Pennsylvania.
Right, right. So I would say that the one thing I would say that is on those platforms, right, that two things happen. The first is that, like, I will say that I think that the shows and the things that they make are actually more diverse in a way, right? Like, for example, I was very curious about this guy. So I watched a lot of Kai Cenat videos because after he was in the dunk contest, I was like, who is this guy? And Kai Cenat is like a dude who's from the Bronx, and he just does this stream. He does a bunch of different streaming things, but he's very creative and he like does a lot of things. He's very, I actually think he's quite talented and very funny. But he has this Taiwanese dude named Ray who speaks very broken English, who he met on the streets of Japan. You know, it's like a guy who just wanted a picture with him. And now Ray is like this huge star in the Kai Cenat universe, right? And Ray like comes in and has his own controversies where he's like canceled because he like said something kind of racist that like, and then Kai Cenat has to like explain to him why it's racist. Yeah, it's pretty funny. You know, like the whole thing is funny. Bobby Lee is a huge social media star, right? Like the sort of Asian Bobby Lee, obviously, I mean, with any comedy, Black people are going to be some of the foremost stars. That's also true on social media, right? Funny mm-hmm. Marco, a lot of different people. And so it's like, it's a little bit less woke because I think that it's much more willing to go back to a time when you could make jokes about identity, make racist jokes, et cetera, et cetera. But in its way, it is actually more progressive because I think that the people just hang out together. They make jokes about each other. You know, they sort of make racist jokes to one another. And it's a type of comedy that I think that if you sort of believe in a pluralistic and diverse and like kind of everybody's cool with each other and comfortable with each other, it's like nice, you know? And I think it actually reflects the way that the kids are not so hung up on this type of stuff, right? Like they kind of just coexist. It doesn't really matter. And so I don't really know anything about television, but I will say that I don't watch anything. I can't remember the last comedy I've seen other than Curb Your Enthusiasm, which at this point is like 35 years old or whatever it is, right? I think Curb Your Enthusiasm is the only comedy that I've seen. Now, is it because all the comedies are woke or whatever? I don't know. I mean, I think the repeat listeners to the show will know I just don't watch television, period. And so I'm the wrong person to ask. What do you think?
I think you're right about like the alternate platforms and like that this is partly a reflection of like who is like still watching cable and television. I don't watch a ton of TV, and I definitely don't watch like a ton of like sitcoms or like 30-minute comedies, except like old ones, you know. The only one I do watch is like Ghosts, largely because they're like very short, and you know, we have a newborn and it's like convenient. It's just like a show about this woman who bonks her head and can see ghosts in the old hotel that she's inherited. And it's like, you know, funny and like a lighthearted way. However, before I was like, hey, we should talk about this Jerry Seinfeld wokeness killed whatever thing, I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, wokeness definitely didn't kill television. And then the new episode of Ghosts aired recently, and I finally watched it last night after I had already wanted to talk about this. And it ends with three of the ghosts becoming polyamorous, and I was like, okay, like actually maybe maybe this isn't entirely wrong. I think you're right that there are just like other, like Shane Gillis is huge, like I think there are, and he got back on SNL after they like fired him for being quote-unquote racist, you know, so I think like there is like spaces for that. I think part of it is like the thing that always I find galling about like Jerry Seinfeld or Dave Chappelle, who make these kind of arguments, is like they're not fucking funny anymore. And when they do the anti-woke or like I'm doing not woke comedy, it's not funny. Like Chappelle's recent shows have like, setting aside whether you not find them, you find them offensive, they're just not funny. Like they're just mean and sad, you know?
They're mean.
It's like, dude,
you gotta stop. It's been 5 years of this, and there's no shock value in it anymore. Even, you know, it just sounds like a guy complaining about his Twitter mentions.
That's a good way to put it.
And in a really nasty, nasty way. And I don't know. It's sad for me to say. I love Dave Chappelle. Yeah. Every time he puts out a special, I hope that he's gonna stop, and he never fucking stops. Right. And it's just kind of sad at this point. And I agree with you. Like Jerry Seinfeld, I don't know. Like, what has there ever been?
Even
like
his,
a
like,
joke
he
that
did that show with
Seinfeld
the people
that
in cars
at.
Or whatever. It's not fucking funny either. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I never watched that either. Comedians in cars drinking coffee or something like
it's
that.
Awful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's when you can't actually be edgy because you're old and rich and, you know, the world has passed you by, but you're doing fine. It's kind of hard to, I think you just start making excuses for it. And for Jerry Seinfeld, for 20 years, the excuse has been like, oh, well, we can't say anything. I was like, what was your edgy comedy back in the day?
It was this golden era of edgy Jerry.
Like, fucking jokes about fucking airplanes. Yeah. You know, like, what are we talking about here? What is your actual thing? I don't know. I think that now things are kind of on TikTok, on whatever. It's not exactly edgy, but there's such a variety of it that it's like, it's funny enough, you know? And some of the people I find on there are really, really funny. And I think like Theo Von is the biggest star of social
media. I like the
media.
Recent profile of him. He seems actually like an interesting like character.
Oh yeah. He's very interesting. Yeah. And I think he's like a bit of a genius, you know, in terms of sort of the way in which he can think on his feet and some of the construction as a writer. It's like, oh man, I can't believe you. Like, you know, he's talking about like how a bowl is a plate with Bobby Lee, and he just says, like, what was the line? I think I've talked about this in the show before. Like, a plate is just a bowl where the two sides can't get along.
that's actually really good.
Like, that's really fucking brilliant. Yeah, totally. And he also makes a lot of weird racist jokes to Bobby Lee, but they've been friends for 25 years.
No, I agree. Okay, like, you know, I agree with your point about the the racist banter thing. I like you said something about it being almost like more progressive in a certain kind of way, and I totally agree. Like, I had tons of friends from different backgrounds growing up, and we always did racist banter, and it was precisely because we didn't take the racism seriously, right? Like, and I think there's like paradoxically the like taboo against racist banter is a function of like not being able to see people as people, and it's like your race is the most important thing about you, and ergo therefore we can't do any banter, you know. I think it's actually like more like a function of like a more racist worldview rather than a less racist one, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you can always tell too when the people are doing it because they're friends, and then and it's lighthearted and it's funny, and even if it's like absolutely inappropriate, then it's even funnier. And then you can tell when somebody is just being a dick, and everyone can fucking tell that shit, you know. And so like there's no need to like litigate it out all the time. And I also just think I'm very unqualified. The only TV show I, as listeners to the show know, that I watch religiously is Alone.
Oh yeah.
And other survival based shows, and you know, there's no racism on Alone
yet.
Yeah, well, because like basically everyone's white. Sometimes they have token.
Do they?
yeah. But you know, I don't know. Survival is not really the most.
Man, I'm surprised that like in the wake of post George Floyd, no one pitched like a woke black survival show. Like only, you know, like the survival.
I bet they did. It might have even been made. I just don't know about it. Although if it was made, I would probably know about it. All right. Last topic. This was also yours, Tyler. Why don't you?
Yeah, there was a recent New York Times article. You know, and this kind of, I thought, just like segued from the comedy thing too, is art isn't supposed to make you comfortable. But what I was kind of interested in just like was the way this gets framed as a kind of American neurosis in this article. I was cackling as I scrolled, but soon a realization struck me. Here on my screen was the distillation of a particular American illness, namely that we have a profound and dangerous inclination to confuse art with moral instruction and vice versa. As someone who was born in the United States, but partially raised in a series of other countries, I've always found the sheer uncompromising force of American morality to be mesmerizing and terrifying. Despite our plurality of influences and beliefs, our national character seems inescapably informed by an Old Testament relationship to the notion of good and evil. This powerful construct infuses everything from our advertising campaigns to our political ones, and has now filtered into and shifted the function of our artistic works. Do you think, you know, I feel like there's been just a lot of chatter about this recently. There was, you know, an Atlantic article a while back that was like, political art can't be good, basically was the kind of, I mean, that wasn't the exact line, but it was a little more sophisticated, but that was the basic gist. Then there was this in the New York Times the other day, and I feel like this like question about you know, because I think there is a broad sense that not just like TV, but like we had this golden age of television for a while, and it kind of feels like we're a little bit past that now for a variety of reasons. I think there's been a lot of criticism of sort of the state of contemporary American fiction in various ways. I think a lot of this gets like sort of tied around the question of is just like all our art too moralizing. And, you know, I don't know. I wondered what you thought about that, or if you think to the extent that we have like a problem with, you know, the state of cultural production, this particular moment, is it, you know, downstream from other kinds of, is that like a second or tertiary or concern? What do you think?
Well, look, I think that there's I'll just talk about fiction because it's the one that I'm most interested in. Which is that there was a period of time in which there were people who would say that any art or any novel that was produced by someone who wasn't a white dude was like political. They would call that political, right? And I found that to be deeply annoying because, you know, like basically it limits it just means that if you're not, the only people who can produce art for art's sake is white dudes. And that was a, this is not like a new criticism that I'm leveling. Everybody said this. But it was true, you know, and I think that there are some people who still hold on to that and they just sort of read European authors and they think everything else is like try-hardy or not real or something like that. And so I want to express that first because I think that's stupid. And I think that the people who say, well, what is political or whatever, they're generally right that this is shifting definition. I think that this is more of a problem of like 5 years ago than it is now. I think that there was a period of time when like everything had to be like the hammer, right? That sort of solved racism, or the hammer that sort of showed what an oppressed person goes through. And I think now we're in a much more interesting space. In terms of fiction, it's a little bit, I don't know, it's like, it's so marginal at this point, literary fiction. It's so weird what actually like catches on and random that it's hard to even say that there's like a machine that is pushing the levers and trying to get people to read a certain type of thing or not, right? Like, I think that people just get small advances now and they just hope that one of the books catches fire, or that the critics really like one type of book, or but I don't think that the, I think we're sort of past this idea that people have to be representatives of a political idea and that the political idea has to be like a big one, you know? And so I don't think that this is as much of a problem as it was before in fiction. Now in movies, that was true, I think, like 4 years, 3 years ago, where like, you know, you had like the Oscars where a bunch of movies that weren't so great won or were nominated based on ideas that seemed like they're mostly driven by the protests, right? The Floyd protests. I think that that was not, I mean, I don't really care about these awards, so I don't really care that that happened. But, and I think if you're giving some people who don't have access typically to Hollywood more access to make good films in the future, that's a good thing, right? And so I think in net that it's a good thing, but did I like those movies? No. You know, did I think that it was an interesting way to think about film? Not really, you know, but yeah, I don't know. I think that these are sort of bygone problems in film and fiction, at least.
What yeah, I think you're probably right. And to the extent that they are problems, I think they're like reducible less to a choice made by like the individual people working in these industries and more reducible to, you know, some of those macro forces in publishing and entertainment that you alluded to. I mean, one of the things that I do find kind of fascinating is the like the sort of cycles in the discourse of these kinds of issues, right? Because like the post Floyd, like, you know, 2020 happens and then there's like a lag and then all of these books and shit come out in like 2021, 2022, right? Because like George Floyd happens and then stuff has to get, you know, bought and, you know, deals have to be made. And then there's like lag time until things get written. And then there's like, you know, stuff comes out a year or two later. And then there also, it seems like the backlash was anticipated because now you have like all of this stuff coming out this year that is sort of like anti-woke, etc. But that was also commissioned like a year or two ago, you know? And so like, I don't know. I feel like there are these ways that we're like on these like strange cycles or loops that are like weirdly out of sync with events. Like I was reading this great book recently about, I'm going to totally blank on the name, but it's basically about the way that universities have a predatory relationship to the surrounding town. And it's not that it didn't dovetail with race, but like there would be all these like non sequiturs about like just like total sort of like racial justice jargon for ways that I couldn't parse. Then it was like, oh, this, like I looked at when the book was published, it was like, oh, it was published in like late 2021. So it's like part of this like cycle, you know? So yeah, I don't know. I think you're right. I think to the extent that, you know, that's a problem, I think it's more a function of other kinds of factors. But I don't think there's, I think one of the reasons that it feels like, you know, fiction and film aren't as robust as they used to be is just like a money thing. I mean, Danny Bessner.
Yeah, they just make Marvel movies. Like, what are we supposed to think about?
Yeah.
Like, are the Marvel movies overly woke or moralizing? You know, but
yeah.
They're like, they do occupy a whole bunch of stuff, you know? So like, what are we really supposed to think about it?
I just think there's like money for like, you know, nothing anymore. I mean, partly to make like good art, there has to be, you need like time and money and finances. And there's just like not any of that really, you know. Like I was talking to a friend who's older and a successful, who's a crime novelist, and his first book, his first big book, Advance, was in the like early 90s, and it was close to $1 million. And it's like, you know, like it's just crazy how much money there used to be in books and publishing and magazines and everything else, and how little there is now. And so I think just as much as like, you know, I think that is more a function of like quality issues than moralizing or anything else, you know.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me. Yeah, there's no money left. All right. Well, if you would like to help donate to two struggling magazine writers, it is $5 a month at goodbye.substack.com. It helps us keep the show going, and I think in the near future we're going to announce some more goodies for our subscribers, so there's an added incentive that you can wait to actually announce subscribers. We do this every week, and if you'd like to contact us, it is timetosaygoodbyepod@gmail.com or at TTS. Thank you. Until next
Cheers, time. Man.
All right.
Quando sei lontana, sogno all'orizzonte, manca le parole.